This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, October 25th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. The midterm elections are a week from tomorrow. One sign, newspapers are publishing sample ballots to help registered voters brush up on their choices before they go into the voting booth. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, this year, for the first time, you can go to a state-operated website to preview your district ballot right now.
Chances are, if you vote, you are by now pretty familiar with local, state, and U.S. congressional candidate races scheduled for this midterm election. But did you know that you will also need to decide three different amendments to the state's constitution referred by the Arkansas legislature? One's all about hunting. The second covers interest rates on government bonds to finance state energy efficiency projects. And the third, also financials on infrastructural bonds. The jargon is so complex you might feel like a deer in the headlight as you stand in your voting booth. But according to Sandra McGrew, Public Affairs Coordinator for Arkansas Secretary of State Charlie Daniels, there's help.
Sample ballots are available online for voters to go to. They can just go to votenaturally.org. They can check out sample ballots, which of course are just samples of the ballots that they'll actually view when they go to a poll. Check voter registration. They can also find polling locations and learn more about the voting process on our website, votenaturally.org.
So once you've logged on to this site, below the first item, you'll see the word sample ballot in bold. Click on it. Then enter your name and date of birth. And all your voting registration information appears, including your polling place location and your sample ballot icon. Click on it and print it for future reference.
Voters may also use their smartphones to view sample ballots and check voter registration on the mobile voter view website, which is also available at votenaturally.org.
And it's also handy to have the location of your polling place, which can change from election to election.
So far, 64 counties are participating in this, so which is a great number. And, you know, really, it's just... You know, Secretary Daniels encourages voters in these participating counties to take advantage of this because previewing these sample ballots before heading to the polls, it's convenient and it really helps prepare voters and expedite the voting process.
But for those counties not posting, other options do exist.
Voters in the counties that are not participating in this program can see sample ballots posted at early voting locations at the courthouse or in your local newspaper. And I also want to mention, too, those who don't have internet access, you know, public libraries usually always have free internet access if they don't have a computer at home but still want to view their sample ballot.
McGrew says this new state service will quicken the voting process at crowding polling places because voters will be better prepared.
It's very interesting because Secretary Daniels has predicted a 54% turnout for this total voter turnout for this general election. And typically, after a new president is elected, those midterm elections, we tend to see, just from what we've seen in the past, we've tended to see higher numbers during those midterm elections than others. And you could see that after President Bush was elected and after President Clinton was elected, those midterm, those initial midterms were a lot higher than those re-election midterm years.
And to beat the lines, many are voting early. Sandra McGrew said by late last week when this story was produced, over 84,000 had cast their ballot.
The greatest thing about early voting is just the convenience. Voters can vote on their own time, on their own schedule. You just never know what's going to happen on election day. You know, you could have a flat tire. You could have a medical emergency. You never know what's going to happen. So this is certainly a convenient option these 2 weeks before the election to give voters a chance to cast their vote. You know, this is what democracy is all about.
At votenaturally.org, you will also find lots of other links, including how to register, information on voting machines, how to vote if you are new to the franchise, even results of previous elections. Polls are open today for early voting from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., and in some places on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4. Early voting concludes at 5 p.m. on Monday, November 1st. Your early voting polling locations can be found at votenaturally.org. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Arkansas Supreme Court ruled Friday on the lawsuit contesting referred ballot issue number 2, and the Supreme Court says it must go through a lower court. So as of now, it's still on the ballot. Roby Brock at TalkBusiness.net has been teaming up with Hendricks College this summer and fall to poll voters likely to cast ballots in next week's midterm elections. The last of those polls, covering the state's congressional, U.S. Senate, and gubernatorial races, has been conducted, and Roby gives us these latest numbers.
The new Talk Business poll shows that U.S. Representative John Bozeman and Governor Mike Beebe enjoy double-digit leads heading into the final days of the 2010 election cycle. In the U.S. Senate race, Bozeman's margin over incumbent U.S. Senator Blanche Lincoln has shrunk to 13 points as he now holds a 49-36% lead. Independent Trevor Drown and Green Party candidate John Gray each received 4% support, while 7% of voters remain undecided. Beebe has seen a steady increase in his advantage, now 16 points, over Republican gubernatorial challenger Jim Keat, 50-34%. Green Party nominee Jim Lindell pulled 3.5%, and 12.5% remain undecided. Also, some new Talk Business polls show Republicans leading in three of Arkansas's four congressional districts. In the 3rd District, Steve Womack's lead over Democratic candidate David Whitaker has grown from 55-31% on August 25th to 59-21% as of October 14th. Republican Rick Crawford has a 42-34% lead over Democrat Chad Causey in the traditionally Democratic 1st Congressional District. However, Crawford's lead has slipped by 8 points since an earlier poll in August. The 2nd District has Republican Tim Griffin up 50-38% over Democrat Joyce Elliott, a shift in Elliott's favor from Griffin's 52-35% lead in mid-August. And in the 4th District, U.S. Representative Mike Ross holds a 52-34% lead over Republican Beth Ann Rankin.
Roby Brock is the publisher of the magazine Talk Business Quarterly and the publisher of the website TalkBusiness.net. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. This is Ozarks at Large, and this reminder, any music that you hear during Ozarks at Large, you can find out the name of the song and the artist by going to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. The University of Arkansas is scheduled to host the 2010 Advances in Breast Cancer Research Workshop through this week. The workshop hopes to provide an opportunity to leading breast cancer researchers from disciplines such as biomagnetics, nanotechnology, microwave imaging, and biochemistry to focus and collaborate on high-risk, high-gain research. Here with more information is Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar.
One in every 8 women is diagnosed with some form of breast cancer in a lifetime. To raise awareness as well as funds for breast cancer research, the month of October is being celebrated as the National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. This Tuesday through Friday, Dr. Magda El-Shanavi, Professor of Electrical Engineering, and Dr. Carol Gaddis, an Assistant Professor of Industrial Engineering and the Associate Dean of the Honors College at the University of Arkansas, will host the 2010 Advances in Breast Cancer Research Workshop with support from the National Science Foundation. Dr. El-Shanavi says the workshop is aimed at research that requires higher investment of resources, but has an equally higher impact.
If you ask what is the motivation of this whole workshop, that was the point. Because I, as a breast cancer researcher, we have several grants, several proposals last year. And the reviews came back very good, but they said this is high risk, high gain. If it is done, it will make a big impact. but it is high risk. So kind of they said, we cannot fund you because it is high risk. We said, okay, so let us see what everybody else in breast cancer is doing. So let us put everybody together in the same room. Let us all talk together. Let us all see the big picture. What is the big picture of this whole problem, right? Because that's why we invited people from every discipline, mathematicians, biology, medical, of course. This is a medical problem, so medical people are most importantly, right? Electrical engineering, chemical engineering, biochemistry, and so on.
For the purpose of this workshop, participants were selected from a pool of researchers who submitted their resumes, a narrative on why they are interested in breast cancer research, and a list of publications that are or might be relevant to the topic. Dr. Gaddis says the conference is more about research than awareness.
One of the interesting things is most of these researchers do not start out researching breast cancer. Most of them start in some other field, like Magda started in detection of mines.
Yes.
And she started thinking about what she was doing there and thinking about how searching for mines is not that much different than searching for tumors in breast cancer. One thing we're looking for in our participants of this workshop is to get not only researchers who are top-notch and doing things in their field, but also talented researchers who have research going on that they could tweak or, repackage, so to speak, and actually do breast cancer research with that.
According to Dr. Gaddis, as news about the workshop spread, many speakers approached the organizers themselves interested in participating. The workshop features renowned breast cancer researchers from disciplines such as nanotechnology, biomagnetics, acoustics, microwave imaging, and biochemistry, among others, from across the nation. Dr. Elshin Navi gives us an example of multidisciplinary cooperation in this field.
From my point of view, the electrical engineering, we are the imaging people. We invent devices or systems to image, a target. So from the electrical point of view, it is the same concept of sending, receiving, then process the data, right? But now what's inside the breast, all those tissues, the types of tissues, this is medical. Mathematicians, they can come to the picture because we do really lots of computer simulations. That's what we do. And they can help us. Biology, definitely, they know what the breast is composed of. So hopefully if we can get more people to work together from those disciplines, I think we have a chance to do something better than what we have.
Dr. Elshin Navi, along with graduate student Ahmed Hassan, is currently researching early breast cancer detection using biomagnetics. For now, she suggests young women conduct breast self-exams and middle-aged women get screened yearly to detect any anomalies in breast tissue. However, some of the screening processes, such as a mammogram, can be a painful experience. Dr. Gaddis says that is something researchers do think about.
One of the main reasons they have those kinds of thoughts about how the pain factor and so forth is because they want more women to get screened. And because women hear, oh, it's so painful and oh, it hurts, they're less likely to get screened, particularly when in the media we hear, well, you really don't need it until this year. Well, you really don't need it until you're that old. And so women can easily say, oh, well, I'll just go ahead and put it off, okay, which can be a mistake.
So which direction is the breast cancer research headed in? Early detection, better treatment, or prevention? Dr. Elshin Navi has this answer.
The early detection is the key because the treatment, the chemotherapy, and the drugs are doing very well. They are advancing. But if the cancer is detected after it metastasizes the body, that's where the hope is decreasing. So early detection, so that's what we are after.
Dr. Gaddis says the National Science Foundation plans to conduct the next such workshop in a developing country such as Turkey or Egypt.
One of the reasons that NSF is so interested in this, in doing another developing country, is because they're at a different point. They're thinking differently. they are approaching their ways of working on breast cancer research in ways that we would probably not be thinking of ourselves. And so really the idea of diversity and bringing people of different backgrounds, different thoughts, and different points in the process can be very helpful.
The 2010 Advances in Breast Cancer Research Workshop is supported by the National Science Foundation and the College of Engineering, the Department of Electrical Engineering, and the Honors College of the University of Arkansas, and will be held this Tuesday through Friday. For more information, please log on to www.breastcancer.uark.edu. For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
And this is Ozarks at Large. KUAF's fall fundraiser was everything we hoped it would be. Thanks to you, the goal of $140,000 was reached Saturday afternoon, making the just-completed fundraiser the shortest ever in KUAF history. Friday was particularly busy here. Listeners pledged more than $46,000 on Friday, our single most successful day ever. Thanks also to all of our volunteers who helped over the 3.5 days and the restaurants that fed them. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, the behavior of bumblebees. Dr. Sydney Cameron has been studying bumblebees her entire professional career.
Extremely good flyers. They can fly easily 5 to 10 kilometers to get food. They can fly from the mainland off the coast of Maine, where my husband and I go during the summers. You can see them flying across the water to some small islands that may be 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers away.
Dr. Cameron teaches at the University of Illinois, and earlier this month, she spoke on the University of Arkansas campus about bumblebees, their behavior, and their importance. We talked with her during that visit. That conversation's ahead, and an artist studio that's almost as impressive as his work. We travel to Western Washington County to learn about the studio of Eugene Sargent. The sculptor creates amazing structures and art, and his workplace is just as impressive. That story ahead on Ozarks at Large. It's hard to imagine Eugene Sargent's mind or his hands ever rest. Certainly his imagination never does. He's a sculptor and works with wood, metal, cement, and other materials. He creates furniture that's art, art that is furniture. He paints, he draws, he writes. He makes computer cases out of aluminum and flashlights out of old tent poles. So it makes sense that his studio near Lincoln in Washington County is pretty astonishing as well. Ozarks at Large's Zann Jarvis recently spent some time there, and she has this report.
Artist Eugene Sargent of Lincoln likes doing practical projects. Though he paints and draws at times, building things fuels his passions most. His bread and butter comes from commissions for everything from public sculpture to literally the kitchen sink and countertops of solid copper. When we visited, for instance, he was casting a series of 4-foot-high concrete planters for the garden of a private residence on Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville. No project has engaged the lively mind of this prolific artist more than the creation of his own dream studio space, where he can bring all his huge machine tools together under one roof and where he can build as big as he dreams. He designed and built the unusual structure himself, and thinking about the design, Sargent decided to include one of his early fascinations.
I have always had a fascination with trusses, like old bridges and things, old railroad bridges, and so I kind of was indulging my love of trusses in this building.
Sargent needed a large open space for his fabrications. He also had to be able to move very heavy objects around within that space, and he needed ample light. To provide these things, he centered his entire building on a 52-foot-long arch.
It's a big truss made out of various sizes of angle iron. It's kind of a boxed-in truss with a sloping top. And when it was done, we hinged it up. We lifted it with two tractors and pulled it with a truck, and it just swung right up. And then I sort of hung the rest of the building on that.
Lee Kane of Springdale came to be Sargent's assistant after he lost his job as a technical writer. Kane had never built anything nearly the size and complexity of Sargent's studio. When he heard Sargent's plan of action, he felt a bit skeptical.
I had a few doubts when I discovered that it was only going to be he and I doing the construction.
Building works because of the strength of the curved truss. It serves as ballast for lifting whatever he needs to move.
That milling machine over there weighs 3,500 pounds, and I've been lifting it from this, from the trusses, and they don't even creak.
The roof consists of three curved planes at different heights with windows in between to allow light to spill into the building. In winter, sunlight will also help to heat the space.
On the southern face, there's lots of glass for passive solar. And on the top of the big truss, is the southern face of the big truss is all glass too, so it's a clear story, and it lets a lot of light in. Actually, I in the daytime I don't need lights at all in here. It just floods the whole place with light, which is really nice.
The building is completed by two low shed-like additions off the main structure. They house a wood shop and a storage area. Like everything else in this unique studio, the walls are not just flat planes. Curved concrete panels bolted together give the outside a sort of fluted or corrugated look.
I made molds that were on the ground that were basically a combination of wooden ribs and a big piece of sheet metal and then a half a PVC pipe. I think it's a 3-inch pipe. So I sawed it in half, and so you get two different curves on the outside face of the pieces, and I cast them with a sort of a interlocking lip, and I cast them custom for each place they went on the wall, and then raised them into place with the tractor.
The concrete that makes up those walls is much lighter than ordinary cement and insulates the studio much better than ordinary concrete would.
Well, the walls are all made out of lightweight cellular cement, which is basically cement with air added, like 50% air. And then they have basalt fiber mesh and chopped fiber reinforcing them.
To incorporate all the features he needed in a satisfying design took Sargent 6 years. He drew the building, he made models of it, and he modified it over and over. In every draft of his plans, he included lots of curves, even though he knew he was making trouble for himself.
Anytime you add a curve, it takes three times longer. And it's really, really ridiculous in a way. And everything we did was much harder because of the curves.
As the building rose among the cows and cornfields of the countryside near Lincoln, it clearly was not your normal farm building. People in the area had fun trying to put a name to what they saw.
When it was just a steel framework, my neighbors from a ways off said it looked like one of those hangars for the airships back in the 20s. And then when it started getting the roof on it, some other neighbors of ours started calling it the dome. And there's some Laotians down the way, and they called it the fun house. Maybe it translates somehow, but so I think I'm going to call it the fun dome.
When Sargent's imagination is engaged, he's having fun. As the son of Ozark outsider artist Sid Sargent, he learned early the fun of making things. His first material was wood. He also helped his family publish the Dogwood Times, a monthly chronicle of country life. In high school, he met a science teacher, Mr. Merrifield, who helped him to win the International Science Fair. With it, he won a trip to Stockholm, Sweden to attend the Nobel Prize Awards. He also got his first media coverage.
I got to be on a roundtable discussion with five or six Nobel laureates on Swedish television. It was a hoot. Yeah.
College took him through various courses of study: electrical engineering, math, physics, and finally graphic design. Sargent kept following his interest. When college no longer inspired him, he went back to his first love, woodworking, and even hired on to construction crews. All of this knowledge seemed to gel when he found a group of like-minded people.
I fell in with a band of artists, is what happened, and we just started being creative together.
Sargent has worked exclusively as an artist ever since. Whether he's on commission to corporations, schools, and individuals, or is just fixing things like wood stoves and tractors for the neighbors, his work has some common elements.
A lot of times, it's not so creative. I just have to just solve problems for people and, you know, build things for them. But I like the practical artist term. That's good. That's good. That's what I am.
Nothing displays Sargent's ability to marry what is utilitarian to what is beautiful better than his own studio. His partner Lee Kane perhaps describes the place best.
The good thing about working in this building is one, the light. It's not a dark hole, and I think just the open, airy space sort of gives a sense of freedom. It's not really as though you're coming to work every day. It's just you're coming out to the country to have a good time.
Reporting for Ozarks at Large from the Fun Dome, I'm Zan Jarvis.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Special Collections Department of the University of Arkansas Libraries is inviting the public to their annual Archives Month open house, featuring award-winning teenage filmmakers Emma and Sarah Balin of Little Rock. The twin sisters will share their filmmaking experiences and preview their documentary Return to Sender about the 1980 Cuban refugee crisis at Fort Chaffee. That event's scheduled for Wednesday afternoon beginning at 3 in Mullins Library on the University of Arkansas campus. If you'd like more information, 575-5577. This is Ozarks at Large.
Singer-songwriter Katy Perry was born on this date in 1984 in Santa Barbara, California. Perry grew up in a very conservative family. Both of her parents are pastors, and they refused to let her listen to any rock or popular music. Perry started taking singing lessons around the age of 9 and learned to play guitar when she was 13. Around this time, she began rebelling against her strict upbringing by piercing her own nose. She soon became interested in pursuing a career in music. With her mother, Perry made several trips to Nashville to record a gospel album, Katie Hudson, which was released in 2001. As a teenager, Perry was exposed to other musical influences. One friend introduced her to the music of Queen, which remains one of her favorite groups. Focused on her music, Perry got her GED and moved to Los Angeles to work with a producer and songwriter. They were unable to find a record company willing to take them on, and her 2004 collaboration with music producers turned performers The Matrix was scrapped shortly before the project was to be released. After having three record deals fall apart, Perry finally signed with Capitol in 2007. Later that year, Perry released her first single. Still, her career did not fully take off until the release of her next single, I Kissed a Girl, which reached the top of the charts during the summer of 2008. With that song's success, her debut album, One of the Boys, made it into the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100 chart. The song also earned Perry a Grammy nomination for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance. Perry has become known for her over-the-top fashions, quirky stage props, and catchy songs. Eight years ago on this date, the Delta Heritage Trail State Park was dedicated. The park is being developed in phases along 73 miles of abandoned Union Pacific Railroad right-of-way in eastern Arkansas. In early 1991, as part of the Rails to Trails provision of the National Trail System Act, which preserves rail corridors by reclaiming land along abandoned railroads for recreational use, the Union Pacific Railroad notified the Arkansas Department of Parks and Tourism of the potential track abandonment. While the northern and southern ends of the trail are reserved for hiking and biking, there are plans to operate an excursion trail along the old rail line in the middle of the trail. On this date in 1962, author John Steinbeck was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Monday, October 25th, 2010. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And today there's a birthday shout-out.
Okay.
Rogers Historical Museum is celebrating its 35th anniversary, and its recent reaccreditation by the American Association of Museums, try saying that three times fast, from 10 to 4 today at the museum, started with an idea in 1974 because it was the Bicentennial Project in Rogers. opened on October 25th, 1975. They've moved once and expanded twice, and they're in the middle of planning another expansion. And if you've never been there, why?
And what's great is for this birthday, they have an exhibit on, I think, the first exhibit I ever saw at the museum, Coin Harvey.
And Coin Harvey is really popular.
Yeah.
You put up a Coin Harvey exhibit, and in the metaphor of baseball, people will come.
Yes.
And if you go today, you get a little surprise birthday present and cake. Mm-hmm. And it's from 10 to 4. And you can find out more at 621-1154. And tonight, if that was too quiet for you, there's a trombone concert.
Yes, there is.
With David Jackson at 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith. It's $6. And how could you not love that?
I don't know.
That's all I got.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. Almost her entire professional scientific life, Dr. Sydney Cameron has been studying, researching, and observing bumblebees. She teaches at the University of Illinois, and earlier this month, she discussed bumblebees and declines in their numbers during a visit to the University of Arkansas. Before she gave her lecture, she came by the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about the intriguing little animals. She told me one of the advantages of studying bumblebees in her lab is that you can identify each bee in the colony and follow its progress.
And if you want to know what might be affecting their behavior, how their changes in behavior occur over time, what might be the mechanisms for these behavior cast changes. So they have, just like honeybees, they have foragers, they have nurses, they have guards, they have patrol bees, and they have the queen. And you might ask the question, like in a honeybee colony, does the nurse bee start out as a very young bee, and then as that bee ages, does it turn into a forager at the end of its life like honeybees do? And that's where I began when I left Berkeley and went to the University of Kansas to ask, what are the factors that are affecting the different behavioral castes of the bumblebee colony, because no one had really studied that. And you can, the fabulous thing is you can mark every individual and you can observe that individual's behavior over time with either video, snapshot observations on an hourly or daily basis and determine what is causing or what factors might be affecting the behavioral changes, if there are any. It turns out that in bumblebees, if you're born big, you're a forager. If you're born small, you're a nurse. It's a much simpler system, if you will, than a honeybee, where there's an age-based change over time in their behavioral repertoire.
Bumblebees, among the most important pollinators we have?
They are among the most important pollinators for wild, both wild and crop, agricultural crop products. So, for example, bumblebees are primarily a temperate group, very, very efficient pollinators of certain whole families of plants. For example, all the ericaceae, all the blueberries, all the raspberries, strawberries, all these things, they're not all ericaceae, but blueberries primarily, cranberries. Those are both ericaceae. Very big crops today. Mm-hmm. Very, very important crops worldwide, particularly in the United States. And they are extraordinarily efficient at pollinating this type of plant because they can do a buzz pollination when they land on a flower. They emit a particular frequency of sound from their thorax by decoupling their wings, which come from the flight muscles in the thorax. They decouple their wings and they kind of do a bzz bzz, and so they, when they do this bzz bzz, they don't, their wings don't move, but instead their flight muscles contract, and this bzz is at a particular frequency that enables the little sporangium, the little tiny, it's actually a sporangium, it's a little pore in the anther that releases the pollen out through the flower, and it lands on to the bee, and off the bee goes with a whole load of pollen. Other bees don't have this. It's called buzz pollination. They don't have this buzz pollination behavior, so they're not very efficient at pollinating any of these ericaceous flowers. The same with roses, the same with raspberries, strawberries, and in particular, in terms of agricultural crop production, greenhouse tomatoes has been an enormous big business all throughout Europe because they can extend their growing season enormously. And they started to rear bumblebees instead of hand pollinate the tomatoes. They brought in bumblebees in the late 1980s. They discovered how to produce bumblebees on a mass scale in Europe, started in the Netherlands, then Belgium, then Britain. And they've become very successful. And they introduced bumblebee rearing into the United States from the Netherlands and from Belgium in the early 1990s. And they have become a multi-billion dollar business for crop production throughout Europe, Israel, Japan, and China is beginning to get interested in developing bumblebees for greenhouse pollination.
So basically, I guess, for lack of a better term, commercially raised bumblebees.
Commercial bumblebee rearing is enormous business. It's less important in the United States, where they started in California, moved to Michigan, and they also have them in Western Canada and Eastern Canada, because our season, particularly in the West, is so much longer than the seasons in Europe. But in Canada, they're big business. And they are increasingly important in the United States as they realize they can also take them out of the greenhouses and put them into the blueberry fields.
Just release them.
Just release them and allow them. They take the colony. The industry has developed a unit colony, shall we say, that is contained within a cardboard box that prevents the cardboard and plastic prevents the queen from escaping. And only the workers can come and go. And workers have a relatively short lifespan, so those workers aren't going to inhabit a place where they're not supposed to be permanently. They come and go into the field, and then eventually, after 2 or 3 weeks, they have a natural mortality. And then the farmer is supposed to remove the box from the field at the end of the season, once the pollination has occurred, and put it away. And that's the end of the colony. And so each year they'll buy a batch of new colonies to do this. And they're quite expensive. I don't know what the cost of a honeybee colony has now gone way up since the Varroa mites and the Nosema and the various other viruses that have caused their serious collapse, if you will, or serious decline. They used to be under $50 a colony for a honeybee hive. Now I think they're up to $175. And I think a bumblebee colony is about $200 plus.
You mentioned the honeybees and the viruses. Are there any concerns about wild bumblebee populations in North America?
Yes. We began a study that was funded through the USDA 3 years ago because there had been local observations of bumblebees disappearing from the West. Professor at the University of California at Davis, Robin Thorpe, determined that in the late 1990s, a species of bumblebee in southern Oregon, northern California, had a very narrow range, small range, but it had been abundant for years in that one range, began to go downhill rather precipitously. So the decline was very apparent to him, and then he noticed another close relative of that species, Bombus occidentalis. Franklin I was the first species that he observed, and then occidentalis sort of almost simultaneously, he started seeing precipitous declines in the populations, which this species was very widespread throughout northern, western, and eastern California, all the way up into the Rocky Mountains. And he basically summoned the alarm, and people began then to think, gee, you know, I haven't seen such and such a species in my meadows in Maine. And then the Canadians got to looking at this in the eastern part of Canada. A couple of years ago, a paper was published. And what they were doing was basically comparing their knowledge of what the populations were like 20, 30 years ago with what they suddenly noted. And we thought, gee. And then a National Academy of Sciences study came out in 2007, and it seemed pretty serious. That very same year, my team at the University of Illinois submitted a proposal to the USDA to study what they'd been observing in the West and a little bit in the East, and we were funded. So all of the sort of local observations were beginning to manifest themselves in the media just about the time we got our funding, and our team was to focus on the reality of these local observations on a much more nationwide scale. So was there really seriously a decline going on? And if so, how much? And what might be causing that decline? And we've just wrapped that study up last spring. And we have a paper in press now on the results of that work. And what we've found is indeed there has been quite a precipitous decline, particularly or almost exclusively within one small clade of one closely related group of relatives, in particular the Bombacensis stricto group. And this has five species in North America, quite a few species in Europe, but one of the species that was used for the original bumblebee rearing, commercial rearing practices in California, is one of these species that seriously declined. So in terms of causal factors of the decline, we know that there have been five species that have declined quite seriously in the last decade. Let's say 20 years, basically. And we don't know if they'll bounce back, but we just know what we've found thus far by comparing records over the last century from museum collections all around the country. And these invaluable natural history collections allow us to determine how many bees were in such and such a region, or at least roughly relative abundances,
sure,
and how broadly distributed was their range. And we know that the ranges have shrunk seriously of these five species that we know are declining, and their relative abundances have declined. So we ask, well, why? And what we've determined is that, in fact, there was a hypothesis that came out of the University of California Davis lab, Robin Thorpe's lab, that it probably got started through the rearing industry. They brought species from Europe the way it started is they took a species from California, they took queens, they determined how to rear these queens in facilities in Europe. And then they reintroduced those California queens in colonies into their facility, and that was the beginning of their commercial rearing program. After two or three years, that commercial industry complained that they had a pathogen that was really hurting their production of bees. And to make a long story short, they eventually moved out of California into Michigan. However, that hypothesis that the pathogens that were sort of hurting the industry in California that caused them to basically leave and move into Michigan where they could rear other species, was never studied. So the hypothesis, the pathogen got out of the facility into the wild, spread to the other close relatives of this genus, and that's where we are now. Hypothesized, but never tested. No one collected bees. No one looked at the pathogen status of the bees. So we kind of looking backwards in time, trying to figure out whether indeed that pathogen is the cause or a part of the cause. It's usually not something quite as simple as one thing, but we think that we're getting close to that answer.
Dr. Sidney Cameron is a professor at the University of Illinois and talked with me during a visit to the University of Arkansas earlier this month. If you'd like to see a list of flowers and plants you can put in your garden or backyard to attract more bumblebees, you can go to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. Also, at our website, you can hear more from my conversation with Dr. Cameron, including how she dropped ornithology to study bees and how researchers conduct studies of bees in the wild. Plus, you'll find a link to beespotter.com to help you identify species of bees. All of that and more at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. That's just about all the time we have for this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large for late October. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Walton Arts Center and the 10x10 Art Series, presenting the dance troupe Trey McIntyre Project Friday, November 5th. This modern dance company will perform Trey McIntyre's latest work, Wild Sweet Love, featuring music by Queen, Lou Reed, Roberta Flack, and Felix Mendelssohn. Tickets and more information about the 10x10 Art Series now available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. First Security Bank is holding a coat drive to benefit the Boys and Girls Club of Northwest Arkansas and Peace at Home Family Shelter. Area residents are encouraged to donate coats at any Northwest First Security location now through the end of the year. Sizes from newborn to 3XL in female and male coats are needed. For more information, fsbank.com. There's a slight chance of rain tonight, about a 20% chance. Best chance of rain developing after midnight. Otherwise tonight, clouds with lows from the mid to upper 50s. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, mostly sunny in the afternoon. Highs tomorrow, mid-60s in northwest Arkansas, around 70 tomorrow afternoon for the Arkansas River Valley. And Tuesday night's forecast, clear and cooler, lows from 39 to 45. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Avoca. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Once again, thanks to you for making our fundraiser last week the shortest in KUAF history. We hit our goal of $140,000 on the nose mid-Saturday afternoon. 3.5 days, our shortest fundraiser ever. Again, thanks from everyone at KUAF, and thanks to those of you who volunteered during those 3.5 days as well. We end this edition of Ozarks at Large with new music from Trout Fishing in America. The duo's been playing together for more than 30 years. Their latest CD is titled Looking at Lucky. This is the song, Looking at Lucky, from Northwest Arkansas' own Trout Fishing in America, and their latest CD, Looking at Lucky.
I'm the luckiest guy alive, I do believe. When you're looking at me, you're looking at happy. Smile so bad I can barely see. When you're looking at me, you're looking at a blue sky. Soft breeze blowing through the trees. I know it's real, 'cause that's the way I feel. Each and every time you look at me. Don't know what it means, I don't know where it leads, but you're like a flower in a field of weeds. When you're looking at me, you're looking at luck. That's the way I feel when you look at me.